From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Michael Goldfarb, filling in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. There's a lot of money in politics and a lot of temptation for politicians. Yesterday, New Jersey Senator Robert Torricelli became the latest in a long line of American politicians to pay a price for giving in to corrupt temptations. He was effectively driven out of the Senate race by plummeting poll numbers, the tangible sign of his state voters' disgust with his actions. But Torricelli is not unique. Many, many politicians in America have been found to be corrupt. James Traficant, George Ryan, recent examples. Vincent Buddy Cianci, another one. Ironically, many of those same politicians have actually been effective tribunes of the people. Yesterday, in what can only be described as a paradigm of synchronicity, author Alan Ehrenhold published an article on the op-ed page of the New York Times detailing the careers of several contemporary politicians who have been driven from office due to corruption, but who are regarded as having done much good. I spoke with Alan Ehrenhold earlier today and began by asking him about the exquisite timing of his article.
No, I didn't relate it to Torricelli. I must say I've gotten a bushel full of mail since yesterday from people nominating their own candidates for the Unholy Mackerel Award. It refers to an old John Randolph quote about Henry Clay as so brilliant and so corrupt that like a mackerel in the moonlight, he both shines and stinks. And some people may want to put Torricelli in that category. Others might not. But I certainly got a lot of Bill Clinton mail. You know, everybody wanted to put his favorite or unfavorite politician in that category.
Do you think that there's almost an inevitability that many in politics, particularly those who are effective, actually, will in some way succumb to the temptations of corruption?
No, I don't think that necessarily. I think there are, you know, some of these people that I write about, corruption really was a sidelight. It wasn't as if they accomplished what they accomplished by virtue of corruption. Let's say you might make that argument about Huey Long, but I don't think Buddy Cianci in Providence needed to make deals on contracts in order to do the things he did for the city. I think it's more of a culture that people simply accept.
When you say people simply accept, do you mean the people, as in the voters, or the people who work in and around the interface between government and contracts being awarded and the kind of work the government does, building hospitals, building roads?
Well, that's a good question. I think the answer is both. Ordinary citizens will accept corrupt situations for decades until something happens to change the momentum. I mean, the Illinois Motor Vehicle Office in the Secretary of State's office sold driver's licenses in as far back as the 1960s. The only reason I didn't buy one is that I didn't know how to buy it. But it was only in more recent years when they sold truck licenses to people who couldn't drive trucks and people died on the highways as a result that all of that culture changed. And I think George Ryan, who's the current governor, somewhat disgraced, although quite effective in many ways, courageous governor of Illinois, got caught up in that.
How did he get caught up exactly?
Well, the practice in the Illinois Secretary of State's office was that you could buy any sort of license, including a trucker's license, if you paid a bribe to the official in the branch office. And those bribes were paid, and some of them went to the Secretary of State's campaign fund, Ryan being the Secretary of State. Later, he became governor and quite a principled and courageous governor. But he got stuck with the residue of a scandal from earlier in his political career, and I think in most ways justifiably.
Now, you've written a book called The Lost City, which is about Chicago in the 50s, which is where you grew up.
Yes.
Now, if we think of Chicago in the 50s, we're thinking of the mighty Daley machine.
That's right.
Now, was that a corrupt machine?
Sure. The machine was corrupt. Daley himself, seems to have been personally honest, at least beyond anybody's ability to prove otherwise. But the machine lived on corruption in that...
But the citizens of Chicago were living in a golden age. That's my point. Or at least in memory, it's a golden age.
Well, they were living in an age which had many advantages, but those did not include the ability to be free from having to pay a bribe to a police officer when your car got pulled over, or having your car taken away by a tow truck owned by a firm that was connected to the mafia. I mean, all those things really, really did exist. So there was corruption. On the other hand, corruption made a political machine possible. It made political power possible. And so all of this is ambiguous. I it's very hard to place this in black and white.
Do you think that there are more corrupt politicians today than in the past?
I think there are fewer.
It's just that the glare of the news media is on them, and whistleblowing, at least since the 1960s, has become a profession for some people.
Yeah. Suzanne Garman wrote a book 10 years ago called Scandal, in which she makes the very cogent point that scandal and corruption are not the same thing. Scandal is the disclosure of corruption. The number of scandals does not imply the existence of more or less corruption. You know, when Sam Rayburn was Speaker of the U.S. House in the 1950s, he had a desk full of cash, and this is well documented, desk full of cash that he got from the oil companies. And if somebody needed it for his campaign, he just went into the desk and gave them a wad of bills. Now, that is a form of corruption, but it wasn't a scandal because nobody did anything about it or cared about it. So, I think that it's hard to judge one time by the standards of another.
And just finally, your own view, do you have a certain tolerance level for corruption?
Yeah, well, we all do, you know. I mean,
well, where would you draw the line?
Well, I would draw the line at corruption that results in the death of children on a highway because somebody got a fraudulent driver's license. If a little money is changing hands in the course of the redevelopment of a city and the benefits are as great as they have been in Providence or even perhaps in Chicago in the 50s and 60s, I'd be inclined to say let's take a larger view of that, sure.
So in the case of Bob Torricelli, you would have told him to tough it out?
Well, I wouldn't presume to give him advice. It doesn't seem to me that anything he did was a heinous crime. On the other hand, in terms of achievements, I don't think he's in the category of George Ryan or Buddy Cianci or the Dailies, for that matter. So, everybody's in a different category here.
Alan Ehrenholt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alan Ehrenholt is executive editor of Governing Magazine, and he joined us from Washington. We're talking tonight about the conundrum of political corruption and good governance. How do we deal with this paradox of good leadership by the morally questionable? Is it something we should be concerned about? Should we let them do their job, as long as they do their job well? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now to talk about this is Darrell West, professor of political science and public policy and director of the Taubman Center for Public Policy at Brown University. And also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, who's senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Gentlemen, hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Darrell West, let me turn to you first. Alan Ehrenholt was talking there about Buddy Cianci. You are in Providence, and so you know a great deal about this. Is there a sense, now that he's been forced from office, that perhaps there was a considerable upside, and that perhaps his more questionable dealings should have been ignored?
Well, we did surveys of Providence voters and Rhode Island voters, and we found that people were remarkably tolerant of Buddy Cianci's dishonesty. I mean, he now is a convicted felon, is about to go to prison.
Actually, Darrell, let me stop you there because we're heard outside of New England, and perhaps you could just quickly summarize for us what Buddy Cianci, as they say, got done for.
Buddy Cianci was convicted of racketeering. Basically, the federal government charged him with setting up a criminal enterprise and convicted him based on that. But the remarkable thing was even near the end of his trial, in our surveys, he was running at around a 60% job approval rating. People liked the job that he did in the city of Providence. Even people who at the same time, half of the survey told us that they thought he was dishonest, many of those people would still say that he was doing a good job. And so voters really have a bottom-line orientation where if they think the politician is delivering the goods for the city, they seem to tolerate some degree of corruption.
Jack Beattie, is that a sign, do you think, of sophistication in the electorate?
Yeah, I think it's a kind of operative cynicism. you know, in order to get by in life, they people understand that sometimes this sort of thing happens. And the goo-goo in politics is someone who wants politics to be just as pure as it says in the history books. Of course, it was never that pure anywhere. And the tension, I think, for most voters, within each voter, is the tension we all feel between our wish to see politicians live edifying lives and our wish to see them be effective and our knowledge that sometimes the ambition that it takes to be a politician, that that's a hunger that once loosed is just very hard to stop. It moves on. It does, you know, it gets hungry for money, for fame, for women, and so that the thing we approve of, the ambition and what it gets done, is also wrapped up in stuff we don't approve of.
Darrell West, ambition, is that something you actually quantify in your studies as a political scientist?
Certainly, personal ambition can lead to all sorts of good and bad deeds, as Jack just pointed out. I think the problem in the Torricelli case is, unlike some of the other figures that we're talking about, say a Bill Clinton or a Buddy Cianci, Torricelli didn't really have the record of achievement that created enough goodwill for him to overcome an ethics charge. You know, with somebody like Bill Clinton, who supervised over a wonderful economy, the people tolerated his moral lapses because they kind of liked the general direction in which the country was going. But in Torricelli's case, you know, he didn't really have the same personal charisma as a Bill Clinton or, you know, other types of popular rogues. And there wasn't the record of achievement that he could point to in saying that, you know, either he had done wonderful things in the U.S. Senate or he'd somehow turned around New Jersey politics. And so when the ethics charge came along, his poll numbers tumbled. And so unlike some of the other rogues who retained popularity despite the ethics charges, his numbers collapsed, and in the end, he was forced to leave the race.
Well, I really would like to keep the conversation focused on the notion of corruption that isn't on the personal side, and whether someone's having affairs outside of his marriage. Because I think that when it comes to the kind of governance that I think we're talking about where the rubber meets the road, as they say, where, you know, in Chicago, you greased a certain person in your ward, you got a certain job, and you got to build a certain contract. And I'm wondering if that is a totally ineffective way of running local government, Jack.
Well, it isn't. It hasn't been. George Washington Plunkett, the philosopher of Tammany Hall, distinguished between what he called honest graft, which is the graft where you connect people to their opportunities. The contractor wants to build a school or fix the windows in a school. You make sure he does that, and in the process, you take a sort of finder's fee. There was that kind of graft, and then there was a sort of parasitic graft where there's no social benefit at all. Torricelli is the example. I mean, he's just taking suits and cash and trafficant. You know, he's dunning his own employees just for his own pocket. You know, that's parasitic. That's just a sleazy graft, not honest graft.
Is there an aspect of efficiency, Darrell? Do you agree with Jack?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a lot of city governments over the years have functioned perfectly well with small-level corruption. But in the voter's mind, I think the key thing is the city had to be making progress. You know, the trains had to run on time. Services had to be delivered. That where mayors got in trouble was when there was corruption and bad service delivery. Then their support would collapse, and oftentimes they would get tossed out of office. But, you know, if you kind of cheated a little and took a little bit of what Jack just called honest graft and still delivered the goods, voters seem to be perfectly tolerant of that combination. You know, we actually saw that in Louisiana in the case of Governor Edwards, who was charged and eventually convicted of corruption, but still was very popular and, in the eyes of some people, was actually a folk hero.
We're talking about the paradox of corrupt politicians, but who deliver good government. On Point listeners, do you have a problem with the odd backhander being passed, a little bit of graft passing in the way your town is governed, so long as the streets are well-maintained and everything is working right? Can you tolerate a little corruption? I'd like to know about that. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. To join in the conversation, I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking in this hour, On Point listeners, about the conundrum of the political corruption and being a good political leader. Sometimes the corrupt can actually deliver exactly the kind of political leadership that we need when we think about kind of nitty-gritty stuff that we actually want our elected our elected tribunes to organize in our society. And we're talking about this with Darrell West, who's professor of political science and public policy at Brown University, and with Jack Beatty, our On Point news analyst. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join in the conversation. Just before the break, I was posing the question to listeners, how much corruption are you willing to tolerate in your government? Any? None? I'd like to hear about that. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm wondering, you know, the phrase representative democracy, does the tolerance that you guys seem to have, and I confess I have it too, for corruption, so long as it doesn't veer into the inefficient and, let's also add, the racist, because when we talk about Richard Daley's golden years in the 50s, it was not always a great place to be, Chicago, if you're an African-American. Representative government, they represent us. That means that they are like us, and we are as fallible, presumably, as they are. Jack.
Yes, I suppose that's true. You look at a politician and you see something about you yourself there. But you know, when we look at the leaders we most admire, what do we see? Harry Truman comes back from Washington, goes back to the House in Independence, and he takes the grips and he puts them up in the attic. And someone said to him, "Harry, why did you do that?" And he said, "I'm home. I've finished my life," you know. Or we look at a Sam Rayburn, who he may have had some wads of cash to give away to campaigns, but when he died, his estate had $15,000, and he was legendary for just the opposite, for never taking a dime from the railroads on his trips from Texas to Washington. It was a point of pride. You're not going to buy me. Never taking anything from the bank. So you know, those figures are the ones, it seems to me, we admire most, because we recognize they had the same temptations. Truman was in part of a machine in Kansas City. Al Smith the same way in Tammany Hall, and yet they rose above it, whereas the James Michael Curleys, the Marion Barrys, the, you know, Buddy Cianci's and other people, they didn't.
Darrell West, just briefly, the history of corruption in the American political system. That wonderful quote that Alan Ehrenhold had in his article, and I think we should hear it again, you know, that John Randolph of Virginia described Henry Clay as being like an unholy mackerel in the moonlight. He both shone brilliantly and stunk at the same time. This is something that's been part of American politics almost from the beginning of the Republic.
Absolutely. A lot of people kind of think corruption is a new thing, and that absolutely is not the case. When you look at American history, the United States was filled with corrupt politicians. Around the turn of the 20th century, leading members of the United States House and Senate sometimes got suitcases filled with cash as a direct bribe for their votes. We don't really see that anymore. There is what I would call white-collar corruption, in the sense of politicians steering contracts to friends and, you know, doing favors for people, but you don't really see direct bribery of top officials very often anymore. And, you know, the few who violate that, are the ones who've ended up in the news. But I think people have the impression there's more corruption now because the press pays close attention to that, and the press goes into people's personal background, and we know a lot more. You know, things that used to not be covered now are covered, and so, you know, when there are violations, we know about them.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Josh is calling from Newton, Massachusetts.
Yeah, hi. I was surprised that Jack was so lenient earlier in the conversation with politicians willing to put their own interests in front of their constituencies. Can we afford to slide into the legal and ethical gray, even when results are good, such as with Vincent Cianci? So, for example, if we take CEOs, even when things looked like they were going really well a few years ago, maybe it would have been a good idea to make sure that they had their constituencies' interests out front rather than getting too comfortable with their behavior.
Jack?
Well, it's a very good point. I didn't mean to seem to sentimentalize this, and I think this is a tendency we all have. In my biography of James Michael Curley, I tried to do just the opposite, to restore a man who was much sentimentalized in Ed O'Connor's novel, The Last Hurrah, to history, and to show that, yeah, he was a colorful character. When someone at a rally said, "Curley, you take the gold out of my teeth," he responded, "Why not? I put it there." You know, he could do a good one-liner, but he was taxing the public all the time, just as this gentleman says. The contractor who had to pay him the bribe charged the city for that whole amount, and that was just like a tax forever on the taxpayers of the city. And since the taxpayers were people who owned property, and since most of Curley's voters did not own property, it was an electoral candy store for him. And so I agree that, we retroactively, it's easy to sentimentalize the corruption of the past, to find these colorful larcenors, people like Curley. But the fact is that if we were constituents of them and we recognized that our taxes were going up because of some of their chicanery, we wouldn't like it at all.
Josh, I want to thank you for your call. And I would now like to bring into the conversation Patrick Murray, who is joining us from New Brunswick, New Jersey, where he's the associate director of the Star-Ledger Eagleton-Rutgers poll at Rutgers University. Patrick Murray, hello.
Hi, Michael.
We just tell us a bit about, we're talking about the history of political corruption. New Jersey has a colorful history. Could you tell us just some of the more famous stories?
Certainly probably the most famous story in recent memory would be the Harrison Williams Abscam trial. If you remember back in the late 70s and early 80s, the FBI had agents posing as Arab businessmen to see if members of Congress would take bribes. A number of congressmen got caught in that net and were convicted, but only one senator in the U.S. Senate was actually caught, and that was the New Jersey Senator Harrison Williams, who ended up resigning his seat in 1981 in the face of the impending conviction that he was going to have.
Do you get the sense that New Jersey voters have tolerance is the word, a greater tolerance for people, for politicians who might have questionable dealings?
Yes, although I think that tolerance is reaching its breaking point. But if you go back to the type of state that New Jersey is, it continues to be a state of immigrants. And going back certainly to the turn of the century, political parties were one of the major means of access for immigrants to enter into the society in terms of jobs, in terms of just becoming part of the community. So political parties had a major role in bringing immigrants into the community, but in that same token, there became a lot of room for patronage and so forth. And New Jersey being one of those types of states, those things carry through in terms of our culture. And so New Jerseyans have become tolerant, probably a little more than they say they would be in Kansas, of certain types of what we would call corruption, as long as they feel it does not affect the politician's ability to serve the needs of the community. We have seen more recently that they have become a little less tolerant of those things.
Do you get the sense of if Bob Torricelli had delivered more spectacular programs than the ones that he delivered on, they might be more tolerant, or is it really over?
Yeah, no, I don't think it's an issue that he needed to deliver more. I think he had a strong message that wasn't his inability to get the message out. What the problem was with Bob Torricelli was that he did not come clean. He tried to stick to the letter of certain allegations against him, particularly when the Senate Ethics Committee admonished him back in July on three specific incidences, and he said, after having said he never did anything, he said, okay, well, there were those three instances, but there were only those three instances, and then he tried to hide or keep from the public view the prosecutor's memo in the David Chang case, which came to light last week. And there's a particular point where people are going to say, even in a tolerant state, where there's smoke, there's definitely fire, and enough is enough, regardless of what you've done for us.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Jeff is on the line.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want to make the comment that I think we do need to be careful not to be apologists for corrupt politicians. You know, I don't think the ends justify the means. You know, good governance doesn't justify corruption. And the other comment I'd make is, you know, listening to Torricelli yesterday, I think was one of the most surreal things I've ever heard. You got a man who accepted illegal campaign contributions. The guy who gave them to him is in jail, and the fellow who accepted the money is in the Senate and making comments like he can't understand why he's being attacked and needs to leave. So I just thought it was incredible hubris on his part to stand up and act as if he's a victim.
Let me ask Darrell West to come into the conversation about apologists for graft. Just stay with us. I'm going to bring you back in after we have some response from the panel. I guess we're trying to find the exact word. Say, we're not talking about being apologists for graft. Jack was talking about hard graft being something that had value. How do you really weigh in the difference between being an apologist and being accepting of?
Well, I don't think anyone really accepts a graft. I mean, what we were talking about was that there have been examples of politicians who were corrupt who retained a fair amount of popularity, and that in trying to explain that, basically the answer seems to be that if they had a charismatic personality or if they delivered good things for their city or state, that that would help them hold on to political support. But I think we've also pointed out that there is a cost to corruption, that tax rates are higher, that service delivery is less efficient than otherwise would be the case. And so voters certainly should not tolerate corruption at all. You know, they should penalize it much more frequently than they actually do.
Patrick Murray in New Jersey. One thing about corruption is the idea as well, Bob Torricelli wanted the money, obviously, and was willing to pocket it, and, along with the silk suits and everything else that Mr. Chang is alleged to have given him. But of course, in New Jersey, your junior senator pretty much bought the seat for himself, and nobody thought of that as corruption because he had the hundreds of millions of dollars to spend to get into the Senate.
Right. As far as the New Jersey voters were concerned, that was money that he legitimately earned, and he could spend it as he sees fit. Now, we live in a country without campaign limits, and in fact, the argument for people who are like that, such as Senator John Corzine or Mayor Bloomberg of New York City, is that we are not beholden to anyone else, so therefore we are less corrupt.
Jack, do you agree with that?
Well, in the sense that they don't need money, but you know, one of the problems in the dialectic here of corruption, people don't like it. They don't like politicians who are on the take. And they had this idea sometimes, I think it's usually unarticulated, but that a millionaire is safer because he's not going to steal their money. But what they don't realize is that the millionaire is going to govern for other millionaires. And so I think the average person might even have been better off with the grafter, who at least had to govern for them. Whereas a George W. Bush, with all due respect, he's governing for the top 5% in this country.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Pat is on the line.
Yeah, I have a comment. I have to agree with Jack that the game of ambition is exactly that. And when you have people who achieve for ambition, they are going to be, to a certain degree, deal makers, and therefore a certain degree corrupt it seemed to me that outside of the United States, this is sort of understood to a better degree, but we seem to be almost naive about our expectations of politicians. They are creatures of a certain kind. And I'd like to know what you think of that.
Anybody can jump in on this, my professional political scientists and Jack?
Well, I think the thing that's interesting is there really is a paradox among voters in that voters want our politicians to be just like us and to represent us in all sorts of respects, but voters also want politicians to be better than us, you know, stronger leaders, more honest, and more ethical. And oftentimes that trade-off breaks down, and sometimes some of these really ambitious people, including even rich people, get the lust for power that can lead to bad deeds and or corrupt behavior.
Yeah, we have a system which rewards that lust for power. In fact, it demands it of our politicians. The system, you cannot achieve anything in the system unless you have that kind of desire for power, and that is rewarded by the voters.
Jack?
Yeah, and I think we are naive about it in that, Malcolm Cowley, the critic, said, no complete SOB ever wrote a good sentence. Of course, that's absolute nonsense. If you look at the biographies of great writers, they were all SOBs. it does tend to be the case that, quote, great people are great in many respects. They're outsized. Their ambitions, their drives, whatever it may be, they're large. Thomas Mann said the artist is allied with the criminal, that there's that transgressive element. And there is in politicians, too. And I think our naivete is that we don't recognize that, this thing of I want money, fame, power, and the love of women, that is not altogether admirable. And in order to get the really effective, supremely ambitious politician, you got to get an awful lot of the stuff that we seem to think we can have without having the driver. You know what I mean? It all goes together.
Darrell West, do you agree?
I think that oftentimes some of the most charismatic leaders often are also the most ethically challenged, and we can cite, historic examples, the Huey Longs, and even Lyndon Johnson. You know, in the Robert Caro biographies, Johnson was an incredible leader, but, you know, his rise to power was funded by oil money, secret oil money to boot. So sometimes, we end up with a package of traits that go together that can be quite problematic.
We're going to talk more in the next segment, listeners, about corruption in politicians. Maybe we can get beyond corruption and just say, picking up on Darrell West's point about Lyndon Johnson, just the largeness and the ego. If the effect is good, does it matter if the man is bad? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join in the conversation. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point. We're talking in this hour about corruption in politics. How much can you tolerate, provided your political leaders are actually delivering on what you elect them to do? And I'm talking about this with Darrell West, who's professor of political science and public policy at Brown University, Patrick Murray, associate director of the Star-Ledger Eagleton-Rutgers poll at Rutgers University, and with Jack Beatty, our news analyst. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join in the conversation. Kit is on the line.
I'd like to hear your comments or observations on what seems to me a kind of a conundrum with respect to what constitutes the best government along this arc that we've been talking about between corruption and purity. By that I mean, if you think that perhaps the honest corruption can serve an efficient kind of, be an efficient way of governing to a certain extent and even give some rough justice, on the other hand, in doing that, don't you somehow favor those constituencies which are best organized at that moment in history to use that, and the others get a kind of a trickle-down effect that is not easy to change because it's all sort of under the table to begin with. But yet, on the other hand, if you look for the Gugu style government of purity and complete openness, then in effect you're honoring the those who already know how to run the world without being too underhanded, because they are the rich and powerful already, so that your constituency becomes them. In a way, that's what we see nowadays.
Darrell West.
Well, I would say that today we actually have the most open government that we ever have had. You know, when you look at the history of politics in this country, I mean, Torch Sally got caught basically because he gave some answers to the Senate committee that were a little different from the reality, and later documents disputed his testimony. But the key point is we found out that information. You know, there is an ethics committee in the Senate. You know, you go back 100 years ago, you did not find anything like that. So we do have a different measuring rod for politicians today. Most people do accept some type of good government orientation as the proper one, and many of the cases that we've been talking about are testimony to the fact that violators are being caught through these kinds of rules.
Jack, earlier in the show you were talking about the New Deal as being the sea change in our society's tolerance for corruption in politics. And I was wondering if it really does come out of, yet again, the late 60s, early 70s, when a certain amount of naivete, but skeptical naivete, went into the notion that, no, we could have actually clean politicians, and they would be better placed to do our work.
Well, there was a lot of that, that's for sure. I mean, and the New Deal did away with boss politics in that it centralized these things the boss used to do in Washington. You know, you got the Social Security check rather than the handout from James Michael Curley. So it really put the boss, whether Boss Haig in Jersey City or Curley or later the First Daily, it really sort of put that kind of machine, which was built on the bribery and passing on the bribes, and just as our caller said, passing them on to in-groups, you know, to the groups that were connected. That was put paid by the New Deal, and what was the other question you had?
No, I was just picking up on your point, and I was just wondering, you located there, and it's very interesting because in this conversation, what I've noted most is once we eliminated, you know, personal foibles like, you know, having sex with young women, that don't mean to be sexist and assume that all politicians are men, but I'm just saying that those are the ones that tend to get caught, that what we're talking about often, we started out talking about the big city bosses, but increasingly we've been talking about national political figures like Senator Torricelli, and I think that you've just clarified it for us, Jack, by pointing out that as so many of the bosses' perquisites of power were centralized, essentially, so that you did get a Social Security check, that may have been the point. But then there's also this sense that the generation that came to political awareness and activism in the late 60s didn't want corruption at all. And it may have been an unfair burden to place on the political system.
Well, you know, that is true, certainly, of the what they call the McGovern rules people, and I was one of them, for that matter, I mean, who rebelled against the Mayor Daley's and said, you know, we have to have primaries, we have to have open systems, we have to have, you know, everything's got to be above board, the day of the political boss is over, and, you know, we got a string of losing candidates.
Yeah, life is full of tough experiences. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Ray is on the line.
Good evening, gentlemen. I just I wanted to make the point that, in my view, one of the problems that we're experiencing in terms of corruption is just the fact that our political system is set up in a way that the personal qualities it takes to become an effective leader are not the same ones that it takes to run for office or to get elected in the country. And so you have these people who are tremendously ambitious, and they're not necessarily the ones that we need to run our business for us. And so they wind up holding office, and the personal qualities of these people are not necessarily what we want to govern us.
Ray, that's a very interesting point. Patrick Moore, do you have a comment on that?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have talked about that, particularly what Ray was saying, is that the qualities of the candidate are necessary, not necessarily the qualities of the elected official. I think Torricelli is certainly one of those people who bear that out. This was a slash-and-burn kind of guy, and when you get into a situation like the Senate, which is very collegial, that makes more enemies than it does friends. And, in fact, if you have anybody who's going to be called friends, it's because they fear you more than they need you.
Jack, let me just ask you to comment on what Ray was saying as well. This is about your point about ambition, but also I wonder if there's a way of getting, I often think that, you know, the best minds of my generation, you're talking about the McGovern rules, best minds of my generation chose not to go into politics. I remember when David Stockman turned up in Washington, amazingly, as the OMB manager for Ronald Reagan, and thinking to myself, well, of course David Stockman would do that. He was, you know, the guy on the platform, the real energy of that time, was so, you know, anti-authoritarian, nobody would have wanted to put themselves forward as a leader. And there's this disconnected situation, isn't there, between people who are most likely to be good governors and people who are most likely to have the ambition to be governors.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, Mario Cuomo makes the distinction between the poetry of campaigning and the prose of governance. And for some people, it's very difficult to switch from one to the other. But, you know, in our modern system of presidential leadership, really, it's all poetry all the time. I mean, it's a permanent campaign that our presidents run. I mean, George Bush isn't concerned with the details of the prose of governance. He couldn't probably answer 2.5 questions about any department of government. He's all poetry. We don't think of him as poetry, but he's all campaign appearances and posing for the cameras. Unfortunately, that has been the dominant model, the presidential model, I think, of recent decades.
Darrell West in Providence, let's take it from the national back to the local. Did Buddy Cianci have poetry in him?
Absolutely. You cannot imagine a more charismatic personality than Buddy Cianci. You know, people loved him. He was colorful. He was entertaining. He actually now is a radio talk show host until he goes to prison, and that's kind of the perfect role for someone like him. And he provided the entertainment and the results that people wanted. And I think that particular combination is very important. You know, you have to have the charismatic personality so that people overlook your ethical flaws, but you also have to deliver the goods for people to tolerate your idiosyncrasies.
Gentlemen, I want to thank all of you for what's been a really fun conversation. Darrell West, Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at Brown University. Patrick Murray, Associate Director of the Star-Ledger Eagleton-Rutgers Poll at Rutgers University. And Jack Beatty, our Senior News Analyst there in Hanover, New Hampshire. Thanks, all of you. And you can continue the conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, Trainspotting author Irvin Welsh visits Afghanistan. This is On Point. Scottish novelist Irvin Welsh writes about the dark and the dismal, about junkies, frantic sex, graphic violence, and the underbelly of Edinburgh's housing schemes in such luminous works as Glue, Filth, and Trainspotting. Not sure if they're luminous, but they're certainly interesting. Recently, Welsh took his pen to another area of the world. For 2 weeks in June, he traveled to Afghanistan to work as an aid worker for UNICEF. Welsh wrote about his experiences in Kabul and Herat in a piece for the London Daily Telegraph. We caught up with Irvin Welsh this week and asked him to read an excerpt.
Later, the resourceful Terry Davis takes us on a city tour where we see that Kabul is, in spite of everything, a place of great charm. While the river from which the city takes its name is almost dried up, pine and yasmin trees still line every street. We head into Kabul Stadium, where an Olympic symbol wishfully adorns the pink grandstand that is complete with executive boxes. During the Taliban era, people were publicly executed here, often hanged from the goalposts. The eeriness is accentuated by the stadium's lovely setting, a great vantage point for the open fields and the snow-capped mountain peaks that surround the city. The stadium guard's as chatty and excitable as he recounts the Taliban atrocities. I'm hoping that the AK-47 assault rifle he waves around has a safety catch on it. Later, we head to a wrecked quarter of Kabul, where much of the fighting took place. It is a rubble-strewn ruin, but even here, a pristine new apartment building stands out like a sore thumb, with hopeful for rent signs in English. You can see the remnants of the electric tram system, which stopped in the 1980s. Now, it's as if the city has regressed into a bygone age. The ruins of a destroyed Hindu temple, long blown up by the Mujahideen, is a stark contrast to the numerous mosques that stand out proud and untouched among the rubble of the houses that surround them. Then our UN vehicle turns a corner. I thought where we had just come from was heavily bombed, but nothing prepares you from this part of the town, referred to simply as the front line district. It's divided from the rest of the city by a big hill upon which sits a now closed restaurant. I realised, standing in his remains, that I was trying to find some kind of emotional vocabulary that would enable me to put what I was seeing into context. The word devastation had lost all application. Most of the dwellings here had been pounded into sand. Children fill in the holes in the road with rubble from the bombed buildings, requesting bakshish from passing drivers for their services. Some, particularly in the rural areas, do an excellent job at scrupulously maintaining sections of the road and are rewarded for their efforts, especially by truckers. Here many are just desperate, bored and hopeful of extorting some change. Stay outside the car for too long and you attract a crowd. The Kabul street children form a mob more quickly than Millwall supporters are the numbers that would do Cardiff City proud. Our next port of call is the Al-Qaeda training camp, where we pay the $5 admission to some Northern Alliance people who live there and guard it, acting as unofficial museum attendants. We're not far from the city, but could be hundreds of miles away. Even with the destroyed buildings and the wrecked military hardware around, this is still a surprisingly beautiful, serene place. A lush green valley, full of fruit trees, divides the battered fortifications from the towering hills above. It's hard to imagine artillery fire being exchanged and US jets screaming overhead. Later, a shopping expedition takes us to Chicken Street, the ex-chicken market, now full of antique rug stalls and gift shops. Flower Street is a former flower market, now lined with food stores. Somewhat comfortingly, you can still buy meat in Meat Street. It gets late and we all sleep over at Terry's, the hosts insisting we have their rooms and beds while they crash out in sleeping bags and mattresses. The curfew is to be taken seriously. The street's empty, and if you're on them after 10 o'clock, you're fairly likely to be shot. Yet despite these restrictions, it's Kabul's nightlife that provides the biggest impression of post-Taliban reconstruction. Shops, especially the kebab restaurants, are colourfully lit with bright neon, while music from Pakistan blares out from every street corner. One big cinema has reopened, showing Hindu Bollywood films to packed houses. Children sell postcards for the latest Pakistani and Indian pin-up girls. All this would have been unthinkable only a few months ago.
The novelist Irvin Welsh reading an excerpt from a piece he wrote about his recent travels with UNICEF to Afghanistan. Welsh's newest novel, Porno, comes out this week. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is On Point.